Welcome to the First Trust ROI podcast. I'm Ryan Isakainen, ETF strategist at First Trust. On this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by Bill Housy, managing director of fixed income at First Trust. Bill and I are going to discuss what is happening in the economy, what that means for inflation, what that means for interest rates, and where some of the risks and opportunities lie in the bond market. I hope you enjoy this episode of the First Trust ROI podcast. So, Bill, thank you for arranging your schedule. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and a little bit tricky getting our schedules to align. So thanks for joining us again on the podcast. So as I was traveling, I had to fly into Chicago. We're recording this at the last day. It's a leap year. It's the 29th of February. And, you know, it seems like everything just kind of went wrong with travel today. And I got thinking of some old episodes of Seinfeld. Remember Seinfeld?
Of course.
One of my favorite episodes is where George Costanza decides that he's just going to do everything the opposite. And it got me thinking that to be successful in this market, that's kind of what you had to do over the last at least 15 months and maybe longer. You know, last year, yeah, if you were an equity investor and you thought, well, there's a recession coming, prices are going to drop. If you did the opposite and just bought the S&P 500, you made 26%.
Sure.
You know, if I was not aware that Bitcoin was going to rip higher to whatever, it's near all-time highs.
Sure.
If I took the George Costanza contrarian approach, I would have bought Bitcoin, maybe sold everything else and bought Bitcoin.
Yeah.
In the long term, those things don't always play out, and maybe the George Costanza approach isn't the right approach, but I wanted your take on that. Do you think that that's the right approach going forward, or do we just need to take that contrarian George Costanza approach? And you're a fixed income guy, so in the bond market, you know, where am I off in that?
Well, I think it's a great analogy for the environment that we've had, and I think you don't have to go back very far to find a very reasonable example in the bond market of what you just described. Remember, it was only October that the narrative in the market, and that's really what we talk about when we talk about, you know, doing the opposite, right? It's doing the opposite of what it's the narrative. What is the narrative in the market at the time? And when we go back to October, the narrative was what? No one's ever going to buy a treasury bond again, right? The government is pumping out so much in terms of treasury debt. Rates were surging into October. And if you blinked, you missed it, right? Because by December, you had an incredible rally from those really attractive levels into the end of the year as rates came down. And so it was a very similar backdrop to what you just described. And these things happen all the time, frankly. And I think that our job is to look at these stories, I call them bedtime stories, in the market and try to put data to them, mm-hmm, right? And, you know, I think for a lot of good reasons, we thought the bond market was very cheap in October. And I know we're going to get into that more, but the data said the opposite of the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really, as professional investors, what we try to do every day is let the data lead that decision making and not as much the bedtime stories that make for the narratives.
Right. So, and that hopefully gets rid of some of the noise and you can identify the signal better.
Right.
And that is always a challenge, though, because you have to kind of go against your behavioral instincts.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about something that last time you were on, you were nice enough to be one of my first guests on the podcast. And we talked about, this was in the summer of last year, how the yield curve was inverted,
yeah,
and how that had signaled almost invariably a coming recession. We didn't have a recession last year. And so I wanted to start there and get your take on, is there a recession still coming, and what? How do we interpret the inverted yield curve, which, by the way, is still inverted?
It is, absolutely. Yield curve remains inverted. If we look at, you know, 2-year Treasury yields against 10-year Treasury yields, the 2-year Treasury yield is higher than the 10-year. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when we look back through time, and one of the things we have done is having studied previous business cycles and managed money through previous business cycles, we've come to learn that when these warning signs flash, they don't resolve themselves in a matter of days or months. Sometimes it's literally years. And in the case of the most recent notable recession, the great financial crisis, I mean, you have to look back at that data. The yield curve inverted in 2006. And you had almost, you know, going off the top of my memory here, almost 2 years of inversion before you ultimately made it to a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, when I look at the data, you know, we, from the point of inversion, call it the summer of 2022 to where we sit today, I would say we're not out of the proverbial woods from that hard landing scenario. In fact, if we just think about what's happened in most business cycles, typically the Fed is raising rates, right? In this case, obviously fighting inflation. And there is a bit of euphoria, if you will, or a breath of fresh air when the Fed says, you know what, we're done raising. And I really believe that's what Powell gave us in December. I think Chair Powell came to the podium and he said, you know what, we're done raising. I mean, that's what I heard him say, basically, right? If I interpret what he was talking about, thinks the Fed has done enough, right? Willing to continue to look at the data, but they've raised, you know, I like to articulate it this way, the equivalent of 21, 25 basis point hikes in a very short period of time. I think the Fed believes that's sufficient for this business cycle. After all, I mean, inflation was 9% and it's come down to roughly 3%. So, you know, it's hard to argue that the inflation is going up when in fact it's gone from 9 to 3. So I think they believe that they've done enough and they want to wait and see. So as you consider these variables, the fact that the Fed has said they're done, you know, the market breathes a sigh of relief, right? As you would expect. And this has happened in previous cycles, right? You know, you can look back to, you know, prior cycles. I think it was roughly February 2007 when Fed Chair Ben Bernanke famously said, we believe the Fed has engineered a soft landing at that point. And I believe it was roughly October when the S&P put in a new high. And we all know what came in December of 2007, the recession. And famously, I believe, you know, Chair Ben Bernanke was giving speeches in early 2008 and still suggesting that the Fed didn't foresee a recession and we were already in one. Now, I don't believe we're in one today. But do I think that the narrative of a soft landing it could potentially be overdone? Sure, I do. And I think that we're not out of the proverbial woods yet, and we'll give it time and continue to wait and see. And that drives a lot of our thinking with respect to what we're willing to do with cyclical exposures, for example, in the portfolios we manage and how we want to be positioned for the market that we're in. But I don't think that we're necessarily out of the woods based on the data.
Okay. I want to talk more about that positioning in a moment. Before we do that, though, you brought up the Fed and how there's a high probability that they paused.
Yep.
And what was pretty much immediately priced in was that, you know, they had not only paused, but they were going to be aggressive in cutting.
Sure.
At the end of last year, I think there was something like 150 basis points of cuts priced in over the next 12 months from that point, right?
Right.
Did you think that was the case? Obviously, some of that has come off. And so talk to us a little bit about how that's evolved and whether or not that has matched your expectations.
Well, let's even rewind the tape a little bit further than that. Go back to September, right? You had a Fed meeting and you had Powell talking about the willingness of the Fed to hold rates higher for longer. And if you really think about what's been sort of unique about this rate hiking cycle, it's been the fact that no matter what Chair Powell said, the bond market has always been sort of betting against it in terms of, you know, putting in more cuts or not as high of a R star, if you will, a terminal Fed funds rate that would ultimately be in the market. So the market was continuously betting against. So in September, you have Chair Powell basically say this Fed is willing to hold rates higher for longer. And the market, for the first time, sort of took it hook, line, and sinker and said, you know what? We believe you now. And what we saw was this move up in interest rates into October. Of course, there was strong economic data that led to some of that. And, you know, now you pair this strong data with what Chair Powell was saying in September. And you get into October and there's some big Treasury auctions hitting the market. And the narrative just fed on itself. But as you fast forward a little bit, and it was maybe late October, early November, it all blends together now. You know, you had Lori Logan out of the Dallas Fed start to talk about the term premium in the bond market and what they were seeing with respect to interest rates and how some of that, you know, those higher back end yields were doing a lot of the work for the Fed and that it was less likely that they'd have to do more. And then it was just a short while after you had that famous December meeting where Chair Powell, you know, sort of said, hey, I think we've done enough, right? It's not like you can't possibly conjure up a scenario where the Fed might have to raise rates again. I just think it's a very low probability event based on what we heard. But that's what we got to. And, you know, the Fed puts out this dot plot, right? And so everybody gets a dot and on the Fed, and they get to say, here's what I think will happen over time as we move forward. And as you looked to, say, December 2024, and the expectations around central bank policy from the Fed, the median, right, that median middle dot point was three cuts. And so, of course, the bond market, what do? They said, oh, three, that must mean six. And so you had this immediate collapse in yields. And it was way overdone, frankly, because it was really dislocated from the data, right, in terms of what we see in the employment, in terms of what we see in inflation. And in fact, I would argue, and I wrote about this in December, that the fact that this is what came from that meeting led to a situation where, you know, it almost promoted the potential for a greater probability that you would have a nonlinear path to 2% inflation. So it's just going to create more ripples because you had such an extraordinary easing of financial conditions mm-hmm. around that euphoria. And that's really what we've seen with higher stock prices, you know, financial conditions of ease. Rates came off those highs, also leading to easier financial conditions relative to where we were. So all of that tied together. Today, you're absolutely right, though. We've seen the bond market wake up to the reality that it's probably not six cuts. I mean, eventually in the cycle, will we have six cuts? I think six, I think eight, right? You know, but is it premature to price those in today? Absolutely, just as it was in December. And so today, what we've seen is half of those have been priced out of the market, and we're looking at a bond market where there's about three cuts priced in by year end, which I would call fair value.
So eight cuts, roughly 2 percentage points. Do you think that it would take a recession in order to encourage the Fed to lower rates that much? Or do you think that irrespective of when a recession comes, that that'll just sort of be a more natural place for rates to be because it's a little bit above the 2% inflation target?
Absolutely. Let me tie that all together. With respect to if we have a hard landing, you'll get that 6 to 8 cuts, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, it's not likely that you'll get that many cuts. Of course, you know, there's an old adage that the Fed takes the stairs up when they raise rates and the window down, right, when they begin to cut. And that's largely because what happens is the Fed does raise rates and holds them too high for too long, which is inevitably what has historically led to the end of the business cycle. And, you know, while we're not at that point today, certainly, when we get there, that is when the Fed does begin to aggressively reduce those interest rates. So absolutely, I would circle those things together. You're not likely to see that. I do think, though, the Fed is aware of the fact that we've gone from 9% inflation to 3% inflation and probably looks at the 25 basis points hikes and says, you know, maybe we can begin to take our foot off the gas. Although I personally think that it's more likely than not that the Fed will begin to address the pace of quantitative tightening first. So that will be the first sort of foreshadowing, if you will, with respect to the next move, which could potentially be that first cut in the cycle. And I do think that as you see that disinflation trend continue to work its way through, of course, it won't be a straight line down. Then they'll continue to work some of those cuts in to the market.
So you mentioned reducing the pace of quantitative tightening. That is going to affect the longer end of the yield curve more, right? Am I correct in that?
Well, I think if you look back at what has been written by the Fed, and I haven't seen anything lately on this, but in prior cycles when we had QE, you know, as the Fed has looked at prior QE and QT, I think that they would probably, or at least have perceived, you know, QT as being an incremental hike. And maybe because, you know, you're talking about something like, you know, $60 billion of treasuries in QT and, you know, $30 or $35 billion of securitized in QT, you know, maybe just given the amount, we've reduced the balance sheet by, you know, over $1 trillion, $1.4 trillion, something like that. You know, is that the equivalent of an additional hike or two, you know, into the market? Probably. I think that's more or less how the market would perceive it. I mean, they're not outright selling. These are maturities that are rolling off the balance sheet. So, you know, there's a difference in my mind between allowing a maturity to occur and forcing a sale into the market. So I don't necessarily think that that's those two things, you know, play out in that way. I think that, you know, when we look at Fed policy, it's really important with respect to the front part of the yield curve. That's why you know, in large part, we have the inverted yield curve. As we look further out the curve, that's more about expectations. Mm-hmm. If I look at a 10-year Treasury yield, well, that really ties back to what are my expectations for inflation over the next decade, growth over the next decade, interest rate policy over the next decade. Will we have a business cycle over the next decade or two, right? I mean, all of those variables get priced in. So it's there's more than one variable at play there.
Sure. So so let's say the yield curve normalizes, the Fed's cut the enough to bring rates down at the front end, the longer end maybe moves up a little bit, maybe it bounces around, it's more market-based to your point. There are a lot of companies, especially you're involved in managing below investment grade companies. I suspect there's a lot of companies that might be a bit uncomfortable that they're going to have to roll over their debt and pay more for that. Is that a concern as you kind of evaluate the credit of these companies and what they need to borrow to continue their operations?
Well, sure. I mean, for the for the best quality companies, the best quality issuers in the market, they realize that they can come to the market now and price a deal and refinance it when rates come down. You know, they have complete access to the capital markets, and you know, for good quality companies, the market's open, right? If for weaker companies, those that were really levered going into a higher rate regime, particularly one that was so at such an aggressive pace. You know, for those companies that maybe didn't have hedges on some of that floating rate debt, for example, they're going to face some challenges, and they're burning cash as we work our way through this part of the cycle. So it really comes down to how long do these rates stay this high before there's some easing that takes place with respect to some of those companies. So at the end of the day, quality companies are going to be just fine. They're going to have no problem printing deals, even if they have to pay a higher coupon. And that's what we've seen, companies where they're, good, strong, stewards of capital will come and they'll say, hey, we're going to address these balance sheet issues. But, businesses that have too much debt and a lot of it floating rate based are definitely going to be squeezed in a higher rate regime like we've had. And they're going to have to find ways to buy more time. And when we've seen some of those transactions already. So that could potentially put upward pressure on weaker quality companies into this next year as we move forward. I think the longer rates stay high in terms of the default rate, for example. I mean, you could certainly see that. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But ultimately, it's a big ecosystem of debt, right? So, there are companies that are really well capitalized, companies with, full unfettered access to capital markets. They're going to be just fine. And they're going to look to price the bonds that they need to clear the market today. And they'll look to refinance those as they need to later.
So it seems like your analysis would lead me to think it's being selective is pretty important. So active management would probably be one of the keys, and maybe it is all the time, to managing a fixed income portfolio. But that brings me to my next question, and that is, as you're evaluating the broad sectors and fixed income and the different credits and where you're being compensated for risk and not, where should investors be positioned in the bond market today?
Yeah, it's a good question. And absolutely, the short answer is you absolutely need risk management when it comes to the bond market, because while buying equities, of course, there's a lot of the potential upside. When you think about buying a bond, it's really one of asymmetry, right? In a best case scenario, we get our coupon and our money back if we nail it, right? If we knock the cover off the ball. So, maybe in a time like today where we're buying bonds at discounts, we can incubate a total return. Maybe if interest rates move the direction we expect them to, that can incubate some total return. But at the end of the day, in its simplest form, the bond market is asymmetric, and therefore it truly is rooted in risk management. It's rooted in process and discipline in terms of how you approach it. So I think the answer is you absolutely need to be very selective and all the time, really. Now, as you think about applying that to today's market, we talked a lot about the Fed, and we talked about that sort of repricing of those cuts coming out of the bond market. But we didn't talk about what that's meant for interest rates. And what has really occurred here isn't that the market is saying, hey, the Fed's going to raise 21 more times, right? I believe the Fed is done, and I think the market largely believes the Fed is done. I don't think that's the big risk today. I think that risk is over. And what I think the big thing that we're focused on now is just the repricing of the timing of those cuts. Now, That puts a much narrower standard deviation around, I think, interest rates from here, at least in the near term. And so as you've priced out from the bond market those cuts, that's had the biggest impact on the front part of the yield curve, because that's the part most influenced by the Fed. So, you know, that leads to the 2-year Treasury, say, going up more than the 10-year. But we didn't talk about those back-end yields, and we should for a minute. So first, I want to go back to the narrative that we heard in October that no one's ever going to buy a Treasury again, right? The bond vigilantes, right? They're absolutely, they peeked their head out, and it was about 3 weeks that they stuck their head out, right? And then by December, we watched the 10-year go from 5% to 380. Do you know what that means? That means there were a lot of buyers of Treasuries in the market between 5% and 380 into December, right? That's ultimately what that means. Now, when we looked at the 10-year in October, and we saw rates moving up, one of the things that we found that was very compelling at that time, and I think continues to be compelling even today, was the fact that when you looked at real yields, so when I'm talking about real yields, what's my compensation for inflation?
And by real yields, just so we're all on the same page, you're talking about inflation-adjusted yields.
That's right. So what, as an investor in the bond market, if I just looked at Treasury yields, what is my compensation as an investor in a Treasury bond for inflation? Not even thinking about when we buy a corporate bond that has an even higher yield or a high-yield bond that has an even higher yield, right? Let's just talk about the Treasury market. In October, when rates peaked at 5%, if you looked at the TIPS market, the embedded inflation rate in TIPS was about 2.5% per year for the next 10 years. That's what was priced in when we got to 5%. So effectively, your real yield was 250 basis points above that inflation rate. So at 5%, 2.5% was that premium to what was expected over the next 10 years. And you want to be careful because, you know, I've seen people try to compare the current CPI rate with a 10-year Treasury. Well, a 10-year is about those 10 years of expectations. So I think it's great if you want to compare current inflation with Fed funds, right? 5.25 to 5.5 against current inflation, a spot rate with kind of current inflation. But as we look forward, we have to say, what is the bond market pricing in terms of expected inflation, and what do I think will happen? Well, when I looked at that, and I said, wait a minute, we're getting 250 basis points above inflation. And so meaning, even if inflation ended up being 3% for the next decade, I'm getting 200 basis points above that. And, you know, I think about how far back I have to go to a time where the bond market was compensating investors in a way that was producing real yields at these levels. Like, you have to literally go back to a time like 2008, for example, to find 250 basis points of excess above inflation. So, and I, you know, off the top of my mind, off the top of my head, you know, maybe the average is 135 basis points. But as we know, for prolonged periods of time, we had negative real yields, right? You were literally under earning inflation in the bond market. So when I looked at that at about 250 basis points, I thought, boy, that's a lot of protection in the bond market from what I think is likely to be the outcome with respect to inflation. And there's added protection at 250 basis points. It's not like it's 5 basis points above what the market thinks. It's 250. And we hit fast forward to today, and perhaps that number's around 2% above inflation, so not quite the 250 that we had, but around 2% above expected inflation for the next 10 years. And I think that's pretty compelling. So when I look at, you know, the 3 cuts that are priced in for the Fed, sure, maybe it ends up being 2 this year. Maybe we don't get that hard landing. Maybe, you know, Fed cuts before the election once, maybe cuts 1 after, whatever it ends up being. What are we talking about, right? We're talking about moving around the timing, because if they're not priced in this year, my bet is that the market will price them in next year. And what happens as this disinflation trend continues to take hold into the end of the year? Does the bond market continue to extrapolate out 2.5% inflation or 2.3% inflation for 10 years? Or do those, does that rate start to come down? And so all of that to suggest that to me, when I look at what's priced in from Fed fund futures with respect to the front part of the curve, when I think about real yields where they are today, I think this bond market is at fair value. I think it's as attractive as it's been in a long time. Sure, you know, even if you didn't lift the perfect top in October, at where we sit today after moving back up from December, I think this bond market is pretty attractive today.
So is there a specific part of the yield curve that you think is most attractive? I mean, should people still be, if they've got a benchmark, should they be at the benchmark? Should they have more duration or less duration?
Yeah, so it's a really good question because, you know, make no mistake about it. If you're out there and you're trying to buy a very, for example, long duration product, where, you know, you're targeting a point on the yield curve that's, say, 20 years out, okay? And there's, you know, as you know, specific ETFs, for example, that do this. And understand that, you know, that's a very idiosyncratic bet, right? I need, you know, this part of the curve to react in the way that I've laid the bet. When I think about fixed income for most people, right, over the last couple of years, the easy trade has just been to hunker down ultra short, right? You know, I think back to, you know, go back to before the Fed started hiking, right? A lot of bond fund managers were out saying, oh, it's okay, the Fed's not going to raise very much, it's okay to buy duration. But at that time, duration was very expensive, right? There was very little yield in the market at that time. It was all duration with no protection, no income protection. That was a pretty bold bet, that, in my mind, right? Betting that, you know, hey, this is safe even though you're really not paid to take that risk. Well, when I look at the bond market today and I think about duration, I think about where most bond fund managers benchmark off of the ag roughly. So think about, you know, core fixed income as being kind of a roughly 6-year duration for, you know, easy discussion. So it's not saying go buy this specific point on the treasury curve and hope you get it right. Now, it's fine if you want to make that bet for a specific reason. But that's like buying a stock in many respects, right? You're picking a specific point on the curve. When I look at the ag, you know, you've got bonds from the front end to the back end. You own the curve. It blends out to about a 6-year duration. It's widespread. It's diversified, diversified across sectors, diversified across maturities, diversified across durations, right? So I think for most investors, you know, that have hunkered down ultra short for a long period of time here, today after 21 hikes, and where we sit in the cycle, I think it's just as bold to be that short than as it was to be, you know, really long going into this cycle. So after 21 hikes at yields and real yields that are, I think, pretty compelling, with a trend probably in inflation that is disinflationary, right? There's, you know, you have to kind of think back to what was the cause of inflation, the massive spike in M2, trillions of dollars of stimulus. The trillions of dollars of stimulus that came into the market, right? Those things are not likely to repeat themselves, right? So disinflation is underway. And so I think that as I look at the bond market today, there's no reason to be bold, right? There's no reason. And I think you can own something in that, call it 6-year duration, or we would think of that as intermediate, right? Maybe you want to use opportunities where yields move higher. My personal belief is that, you know, the 10-year treasury probably tops out around 4.5 to 4.55 in this move. I think there's a lot of FOMO in the market, right? A lot of investors feel like, boy, I wish I bought in October. So they're going to be coming out of the woodwork as rates, you know, do make that move. You're going to have some, you know, bedtime stories about how at 4.5%, that means they're going to 5.5 or 6. But I do think the bond market is a lot more durable today after 21 hikes. And that kind of proved itself through October even. And so I think that intermediate is a very comfortable place for most investors today based on risk tolerance, because I do think the risks are more balanced today.
So, Bill, a couple times you have mentioned the term asymmetry, asymmetric returns. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by asymmetric returns in the bond market?
Yeah, I mean, there's this, you know, there's this fancy word in the bond market. We call it convexity. And, you know, it's the nonlinear relationship between interest rates and bond prices. And it's, you know, a lot of people hear this word and they say, boy, I don't ever want to learn that again. If they've ever had to learn it for a licensing exam or something like that, I just call it bond market magic, right? Let's just call it what it is. When I look at bond prices, remember, a bond is a mathematical equation, right? It's got a maturity, it's got a coupon, maybe call provision, perhaps some credit risk. These are things we can calculate, we can account for. When we look at a bond, we can shock a bond's value. What happens to the price of that bond if interest rates go up? What happens if rates go down? Well, when we were shocking bonds back in December 2021, before the Fed embarked on this, you know, 21 hike expedition, right? There was no protection in the bond market. It was a completely linear relationship
between bond price and interest rates for the most part, right? You had very little protection because you had very little coupon.
Well, after 21 hikes, the bond market has insulation again, some shock absorption again. It has some income. And very simply put, if I buy a bond that has a 5% coupon, or in the case of high yield, then 7% or 8% coupon, right? I have to lose 5 or 7 or 8% before I lose a dime, because over the course of 12 months, I'm going to carry that coupon. That carry is going to offer some insulation. So as rates have reset higher and yields have reset higher, what we're seeing now is when we shock our bond prices, the drawdown on, say, the next 100 basis point move, let's just say, for example, Treasuries went up another 100 from here, right? The drawdown is a lot more durable because of the carry that you're getting. However, if rates go down, it's an asymmetrical turn up in the potential return of these bonds in the market today, based on that convexity that exists in large swaths of the market. So, you know, it's the math driving that decision, right? There's this extraordinary asymmetry that's building into the market at these higher rates that didn't exist before COVID. The math has changed, right, after COVID into those lower yields, right? So the math is much better today than it was then from an asymmetrical return perspective.
Bill, I'm also wondering, given that it's an election year and, you know, the Fed is supposed to be completely separate from any politics, but I sometimes wonder if that in reality is the case. And I'm curious what you think with respect to, I don't know, the influence that being an election year will have on Fed policy. Do you think that that will be in, at least in the back of the mind of Jerome Powell later this year?
Well, I'm not a mind reader. And, you know, there's an old saying, and I it probably stems from law enforcement at some point, but it's made its way into my lexicon with respect to what I do every day. And it's, you know, follow the money to find the motive, right? And so when I think about, you know, if I were chairman of the Federal Reserve, right, would I be thinking about, boy, I like this job. Boy, I'd like to keep this job, right? And you have the potential for two candidates and one who has openly said, hey, I know this isn't my guy, right? And so, you know, you'd like to think that it's not at play, but at the same time, it's hard to imagine it isn't on the minds of some of these officials, right? It would be sort of unnatural if it weren't, right? So I think at the end of the day, though, you really have to believe that the people that are making these decisions are making them based on the data. They're making them based on the belief that they're making the best decisions they can to you know, address the inflation problem, to avoid a recession, right? So I, you know, certainly will give the people the benefit of the doubt that are in these seats, but of course you always wonder, right? So, you know, I wish I had a perfect answer for that one, but I don't, my friend.
Conscious or unconscious,
yes.
It seems like that has to play into at least in the back of their mind somewhere. But again, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Okay, my last question for you, Bill. Is what are you reading these days? Is there anything, I'm trying to, it's been great because every guest that I have on the podcast, I tend to ask what they're reading, and I've got this great book list that I'll probably never get through, but is there anything that either you've read recently or is on the horizon that you're considering reading that you would recommend?
The one I just finished, last time I was on with you, we talked about Ernest Shackleton.
That's right.
Right? So we talked about that in our conversation, and I just finished, by the recommendation of a friend, River of Doubt.
Okay.
And it's about Teddy Roosevelt and his expedition to go after losing re-election to, you know, basically explore the Amazon. And it's an unbelievable story.
Wow.
And, you know, if you're into these sort of real stories about expeditions that have taken place, I mean, I read this story and I think about Teddy Roosevelt as kind of being like a, you know, back in his day, the David Goggins. I mean, this guy would have something hard that happened to him, and he's like, "I'm going. Like, let's go down to the Amazon," and which is by at that time was just a blob on a map. You know, the Amazon River was just a blob on a map, hadn't really been explored. You know, really dangerous conditions, and so I won't spoil the story, but it's a pretty cool story.
Oh, that's great. I bet you he had a big gun where he killed some pretty interesting animals in that expedition.
I'll let you read the story.
I'll read the story and find out. Well, Bill, it's always a pleasure to having you on the podcast. We'll have to do this again soon. Thanks again for joining us, and thanks to all of you for joining us on the First Trust ROI podcast.